I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Call it the David Carr pause in the American conversation, somewhere between the rescue of big old media and its replacement by digital upstarts with an entirely different tone of voice. David Carr, the honored prophet who died last week at 58, was a favorite of both forces in the collision here, the old and the new. He wrote his own techie Notes from Underground in the gravelly tones of a crack addict on the rebound with a vision of the future. And he got famous for delivering those notes in the august columns of the esteemed but no longer profitable New York Times, which he revered. David Carr extended the romance of newspapers, but still the buzz and the investment money are all around the digital kids on the block, BuzzFeed, Vox, Vice. This is our David Carr show, alas, without the man himself. The main question is what news and media have to do with truth that stands up. Other straws in the wind. Bob Simon of CBS is dead, the best of the Cronkite era. Jon Stewart, the best of the new joke journalism, is leaving. His protege in news satire, Stephen Colbert, is on the move. Also, the big investment play in new media brand names that not everybody has met. BuzzFeed, Vox, and especially Vice, raising hundreds of millions of dollars. Where are we going for information and public wisdom about our world? Chris Lehman is with us for the hour, co-editor of Book Forum and of the Young Tough Baffler magazine. Also, Derek Ashong, the poster guy for global millennials in multimedia. Also, Aisha Siddiqui, an American woman with Pakistani roots who's been in and out of BuzzFeed already, now editing the new Inquiry online from Brooklyn. And Laurie Penny, rising young journalist on the way up from London in our studio. Chris Lehman is with us from Washington, trained as an historian, drawn to every kind of journalism, in and out of the Washington Post, the magazine Tikkun, Yahoo News, now co-editor of the admirable Book Forum and The Baffler. It's clear you write and you read much too much, Chris. In all the coming and going in the recent days, what's important here?
Well, I think you alluded to it in your introduction. There is a truth gap. For anyone who's studied the history of American journalism, it's not especially new. I think it's accelerating under present conditions. And I think there are more incentives to sort of, if not to fall into line behind official state lies, as we saw in the run-up to the Iraq War, than to be a sort of genial jokester. And the interesting thing about the Brian Williams case is that it sort of combines both of those impulses, right? There's this kind of eagerness to please, to be a good talk show guest, to go on 30 Rock and slow jam the news with Jimmy Fallon, all of these kind of things to let you know that the old establishment kind of white guy in a suit is down with the kids. but the larger story that does pertain to the Iraq War is that all of journalism functions, it's a subculture like any other profession. It's very common down in D.C. to liken political journalists to high school kids. They're always, checking out each other's status and talking dirt behind each other's backs. But I actually think the more apt metaphor is the mafia, not so much that there are, people being whacked behind warehouses or whatnot, but there is a sort of omerta, a code of silence that allows everyone to sort of function in the same reassuring universe of accepted premises and opinion. And then the one thing that was funny to me in the fallout from the Brian Williams scandal, I guess we can call it, one of the first things I read was Joe Klein in Time magazine, who I do regard as kind of like, the avatar of blowhardism in our time. And he,
there's so many.
Yes, there are. It's a rich cornucopia. But Joe Klein took to Time's website to sort of defend Brian Williams' honor. And he scowled and said, he's getting all of this flack from all of these no account, kids and digital journalists none of whom have ever seen the inside of a Chinook helicopter, which is like this weird, and this is the other sense in which it's like the mafia, right? It's intensely male, and it's intensely kind of like, you know, you have to show like, you know, war wounds and blood and guts, and you know, that's the calling card of authenticity in this world.
But it's so at war, Chris, I've got to say, with our notions of a robust, contentious media, First Amendment, you know.
Exactly.
But how do we explain, looking back, that in this First Amendment country, not one newspaper, not one cranky editor in Florida or Oklahoma said, no way, this is absurd?
Well, McClatchy News, to its credit, did a lot of good reporting around...
reporting, yes, but I'm talking about... Wait a sec, this is a non-starter. This is neo-colonial, you know, suicide.
Well, you know, there was, of course, all of the kind of rush... You know, there is the 9/11 trauma was real, and...
Of course.
What's sad is, and yet predictable to people in, you know, who know Washington, I guess, is that there were, you know, there was a battery of cynical apparatchiks poised to exploit this. I have this very vivid memory long, you know, I moved down here just around the time of the 9/11 terror attacks, and I actually went to a dinner at Christopher Hitchens' house, a week after the attacks. Mm. And much to my kind of astonishment, because I had been functioning, you know, I had never lived in Washington before. I didn't really know how these things worked. So I get there, and one of the guests is Grover Norquist, who I, you know, very genial man, but also in terms of my own politics, kind of satanic, let's say.
Get the government into the bathtub and strangle it. Yeah, that guy. Right. Okay.
And the weird thing about this whole evening is that through the entire night, Hitchens and Grover Norquist talked incessantly about Iraq and the imminent threat of Iraq. And I kept saying, like, you know, from what I gather, all of these attackers were Saudi Arabians. You know, what is the obsession with Iraq was, you know, in that environment, no one from the Bush administration had stepped forward at this early stage to kind of say that, you know, Saddam Hussein was a puppet master behind the attacks and all that. You know, Dick Cheney was just sort of warming up, I think, in the locker room. But here I was at this event, and it was completely, you know, unbelievably bizarre. Mm. And it was only obviously several months later that I sort of understood what was happening where I was.
You were hanging around the Washington Post around the time that Colin Powell went to the UN. I mean, what did you learn in that whole atmosphere?
Well, that was another one of these, you know, I had a series of very rapid, rude introductions to journalism in Washington. I remember being at the Washington Post and, you know, went the run-up to Colin Powell's speech. You know, Colin Powell is himself... was at you know, prior to all this kind of revered centrist Cincinnatus figure, that, you know, the kind of stoic general who's very mm-hmm. reluctant to commit troops, all this. So there was, you know, this weird kind of almost celebrity buzz around this appearance, and the newsroom sort of ground to a halt. Everyone stood around TV monitors watching the presentation, and, you know, I remember, you know, many people pronouncing themselves convinced in that moment that, you know, they knew, because Colin Powell had made this, you know, unassailable case, that it was necessary to invade Iraq. And I it was another one of those moments, like the night at Hitchens's, I felt like, where am I? Mm. I was working for the book section, so my opinion didn't count for anything anyway, but I would ask people, you know, did I miss something? Because I just saw, you know, a lot of stills that looked like, you know, kind of outtakes from the second Star Wars movie. There was nothing that, you know, sort of said to me, you know, oh my God, we're on the, you know, brink of a WMD, you know, attack.
Chris Layman, look ahead. We're wondering about the alternatives, the rising tide of new media, and I'd love you to review particularly the ones that are getting lavishly funded with capital. Well, Vice. It's
an interesting thing. Yeah, Vice has been around for a while, and it came to the attention of Rupert Murdoch, who, again, as I was kind of describing Brian Williams, you know, trying to show you what's down with the kids, Rupert Murdoch, in kind of famously on Twitter, said, like, does anyone know anything about this magazine, Vice? The millennials seem to love it. And, you know, boom, you know.
Just raised $500 million for the future. Their model seems to be a kind of titillation of, you know, there's some strong content in there, but it has this kind of scandal, tabloid, almost pornographic tease about it.
The Baffler published a critique of Vice by Anne Elizabeth Moore, a very good feminist journalist, right after the Murdoch deal was done. And the headline of it was the vertically integrated rape joke. I mean, Vice really does have a very ugly history among its founders. And all you have to do is log on to the site at any given moment. It is, I would say it's beyond titillating. Its content is kind of overtly misogynistic.
There are other kinds of alternatives, some of them worthy for different reasons, sort of news as comedy after the model of Jon Stewart, news as snark or sarcasm, the Gawker model, so to speak, news as marketing, Yahoo News that knows more about your consumer preferences than God, practically. We're talking about new media and the old with Chris Lehman and lots of others. Coming up, get over the technology of it. What's really different about the new media is that it's about and for and by different people. This is Open Source. In the wake of the prophetic David Carr of the New York Times and Boston University, he died a week ago tonight, we are chasing the essential story, if there is one, in the news of new media. From our producer, Connor Gillies, here is a montage of it. New sound, look, lingo, music. Attitude.
Power of data.
Data journalism.
Data journalism.
Key data, key reference elements.
Because numbers are so strong, it's not about opinion, it's about what's really there.
Data journalism, data visualization.
Data journalism.
Data, visualize data.
Storytelling techniques on data.
It lets you tell a story.
You know, we all have stories to tell, and I want to find people that are as hungry as I am.
Power your podcast with storytelling.
I always start with the story. Story, an emotional story. Story idea. Story, maybe that's an audio story. Data. Illuminate this story and promoting that content and really make the story central. If it's a Storify of tweets.
Is BuzzFeed a technology company?
We're definitely a technology company. Our reporters having great judgment, our entertaining content, being great storytellers, but then everything else is technology.
Both advertising and editorial have the same goal, to engage the reader.
Content which is paid for by the advertiser.
Content.
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 But are there shifts of substance here? New messages in the new media. I put the question this week to a global star across the board. Derek Ashong is a singer and actor. He's been a star on YouTube, Al Jazeera, Fusion, and he's still humble, still exploring. I asked him, how does the new media be more than trivia, sales, titillation?
You know, it's funny. It's a great question, Chris. And see, for me, I look at it almost in the opposite way. I think that the mainstream media has for a long time now been about sales, ratings, titillation, the entertainmentization of the news and of what matters in our society. We need to package it. It's got to be short. We got 2 minutes to cover this. Give me the buzzwords and let's encompass all the complexity of humanity in our 30-minute evening news broadcast. Or better yet, let's reiterate the same tired tropes for 24 hours a day on our all-day cable news channels. I think that that has actually been a big part of the demise and the diminution of the value of media and thereby of the value that people place in it and the trust that people place in it. So I think part of what we see happening is that the new media platforms and the new voices are popping up because people don't have the same faith they used to in the old voices. We don't have the Walter Cronkites of today. And what we're looking for is some way to parse through all the noise to get to that fundamental human yearning for truth, or for reinforcement, frankly, because a lot of people just want to hear something that tells them that they are already correct. And this is the battle we face today. This is the battlefield for how do we parse through all of that to help people know what they need to know to make decisions that matter for our world.
Some of these new media have a completely different look and feel in the content, covering Barack Obama, for example. Old media would show you Bob Pierpont or Sam Donaldson standing in front of that White House. Hello, back to you, Walter, or whatever the president did today. There was a piece on BuzzFeed in which they talked President Obama into sort of, let's reveal what you do, what you look like, what expressions you make in a mirror when nobody else is looking. And most of the time, he's taking his three-point jump shot. You know, he's walking around the White House between meetings, hitting threes. What's the next step?
I mean, I think the next step gets ever more interesting, right? Because, and I love the example that you gave, this idea that, hey, we're going to take that traditional leader and we're going to show them out of context. I think that we have to start breaking down further orthodoxies. Look what's happened in our society over the last, let's say, 7 years. We've seen a complete flipping in the value that we place on venerable institutions. We don't see the banks the same way. We don't see the government the same way. We don't see the church the same way. We don't, and this is happening all around the world. And so I think that starting to take that vision, that view behind the scenes, that view of the things that we normally won't look at, the voices of the people that we normally don't want to hear from, those topics, those horrible, ugly truths, as I like to call them, that we don't normally want to tackle, that we're going to start wrestling with them much more actively, because that's where the world is going. Hmm. Once you remove the gatekeepers, everyone is literally, it's looking at the emperor and saying, this person has no clothes. And that is what happens when you democratize media. If the gatekeeper is not there to spin you the emperor's new yarn, then you can see for yourselves that this man needs some other gear. I think that part of what we have to do as a mature society is look at ourselves and at our neighbors in the context of history. And we are in a moment of radical change right now. We are in a moment where more people have more of an influence or more of a voice on what they see in their world than has ever existed in the history of humanity. And that means that the ways in which we manage, maintain, amplify, and hear and parse through those voices are yet to be truly refined and maybe even discovered.
Think of the big money that new media has been raising recently in the hundreds of millions. What does that tell you about the future?
It tells me that the investment class realizes that there is a weakness in the existing model. And where there's a weakness in the existing model, there's opportunity for new models. So they're out there experimenting. They're hunting for a deal. They're looking for an opportunity. And I think that's a good thing. I think that investors are looking and they're saying, hey, this has all got to shift. So where is the marketplace going?
What is your model in 2015 of a workable model of democratic media?
Okay, so my personal bias is towards Twitter, right? And I love it because you have all of these individual publishers, some of whom are publishing the cat videos, some of whom are publishing the videos of the terrorist acts they're about to undertake, some of whom are publishing their latest newscast, some of whom are publishing their thoughts on the red carpet at the Oscars, but all of whom are engaged in this constant dialogue and this intersection, this rubbing of ideas and of people and of voices against one another. I don't think that Twitter is the end game. I don't think that they have solved the problem of collecting, curating, and amplifying important voices in our public discourse. But I do think that they have moved the ball forward in a very big and a very important way. You know, there's this phenomenon called Black Twitter, where you have all of these people talking about things that matter in their communities, and a very powerful representation of African-American women talking about things that matter to them. If you look at the news media, if you look at the entertainment media, you'll find that not only are Black women's voices very limited in what we hear from them, but also when they are represented, it's still in a very limited fashion. And yet you have these women on Twitter talking about their politics, about their identity, about their values, about their vision, about their struggles, about their woes, about their love, about their lives, about their passions, about the people in their communities and the things that they matter, that matter to them, about their aspirations. And I don't know where else you can find that. So when I look at that, I see the breeding ground. If Twitter is not the end game, Twitter may be where we are planting the seeds of what's yet to come.
That was Derek Ashong, who's working on his own musical venture called AMP in the media space. Chris Layman, what's the promise of new gatekeepers and who appoints them?
It's funny. I was listening to Derek's remarks, and there's a lot in there I want to be able to endorse. But I worked at Yahoo, which was the sort of mother of overcapitalized and big audience news ventures on the web. And I found it was a real day-to-day struggle to get news out in front of Yahoo readers that wasn't prepackaged to sort of flatter their taste preferences. And, you know, there were the most constant refrain intoned in that very funny montage that your producer put together was data. Yahoo uses its data in a very interesting and I think a disturbing way that for people who care about the democratic function of the press. Their homepage is directed by something called CORE, which is called stands for the Content Optimization and Relevance Engine. And basically, it is able to go through your web history, your browsing preferences, and deliver a version of the news that tickles your exit. You know, the things that make you shop on the web. Let's say
not so far removed from the New York Times Styles section, but no, I wonder, is it more a marketing device than a news device? It's a huge news source.
The two forces are increasingly indistinguishable in this media world, which is why I think, you know, it's nice to think that everything is automatically being democratized because the gatekeepers are given the heave-ho. And I have had plenty of run-ins with gatekeepers in my career. I'm no fan of them per se. But again, I wrote at great length about my Yahoo tenure in the forthcoming issue of The Baffler. And I found that the gatekeepers at Yahoo, for example, one of the funniest things that happened when I was there was prior to the 2012 election cycle, they were trying to piece together, you know, how are we going to cover this in the realm of opinion? You know, this very idea of, you know, tapping this vast audience of, you know, kind of unmediated responses to the election cycle. And we, you know, first of all, started off with a project called Ask America, which kind of fell flat on its face. That was because, you know, the America represented on Yahoo tended to comment in very vituperative and, you know, unproductive and sometimes hateful ways. And
Chris, I want to come back to this matter of investability and real democratic media promise, but I want to introduce Laurie Penny, who's with us in the studio. She speaks new media with an English accent and a critical mind fixed since childhood on what the news is actually doing to us. She's a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University this year. What about new gatekeepers, Laurie?
Well, firstly, I want to say that I do agree with Derek's optimism and his passion for the democratizing power of new media. And as a writer, a journalist, and as a young woman, a young queer woman who is openly feminist, I wouldn't have the same writing career I have now if it weren't for Twitter, even Facebook, for Blogspot, where I started LiveJournal, because I've always found that if there was something I wanted to say, if there were stories I wanted to push, then my editors weren't accepting them, if I was being channeled into writing fluff stories, fashion stories, I mean, if you you're looking at me now, if you were in the studio, you could see that I'm not the most fashionable of people, but apparently...
Being, oh, don't underestimate yourself, child.
But being under 25 and in possession of a pair of breasts means you must know everything about fashion, obviously, and nothing about politics. That's where I was channeled, but that didn't matter so much because I could go on Twitter, I could go on Blogspot, I could get the stories out that I wanted to get out there. And I've seen in the last 6 years a great change and, you know, an immense amount of new voices coming in. And I think what both Derek and Chris are getting to is that the people who produce media, the people who create media, and the people who consume media are the same right now. We are all consumers and creators of media, and people across the world, and this is the danger, investors across the world, huge companies, old, what we would now call legacy media, are beginning to see that as an investment opportunity, as a place to expand and consolidate the power that they were afraid of losing. Murdoch, the man who entertained Thatcher, the man who dined with David Cameron and invited criminals in to run his media empire, the man who was lately on trial before the British public, is now, you know, investing in a chunk of Vice Media. This is where they see the future. So I am incredibly optimistic, but I also see a danger, particularly over the next 12 months right now, in maintaining our freedom. Because, you know, we can see, like Derek says, we can see that the emperor has no clothes, but unfortunately under his clothes, the emperor is a doughy old white guy, and he's still paying our salaries.
I want to introduce another voice on the gender dimension in this whole new media question. Aisha Siddiqui is a young journalist born in the U.S. of Pakistani parents. She worked her way into BuzzFeed and then out of it into an online collective called The New Inquiry. I asked her, what is her test of relevance among the new voices?
The voices that we're going to see becoming and staying relevant is honestly sometimes as simple as the people who wouldn't aspire to be or identify with being explainers or pundits. That's a role specific to a certain attitude that's informed by your position in society, like white, male, and in a suit. That's who we're comfortable explaining to us. That's who we're comfortable getting our commentary from. Undermining the idea and eventually, ideally, discarding it entirely that a white man in a suit who chatted with a taxi cab driver one afternoon is qualified to explain the political and cultural climate of a foreign country, the person who makes that no longer relevant, that's who's going to be relevant. So I'm looking forward to the generation of writers and commenters and critics who replace the pundit class, who replace the very stale op-ed pages of newspapers across the board. I mean, part of what makes this time so exciting is that we're finally approaching a sense of like how there are consequences for bigotry. And so I have no patience for people wanting to deride in any way our current moment as outrage culture. I think that's a very thinly veiled attack at the fact that we're finally hearing from voices that were traditionally silenced or barred. And anyone from this moment is producing unease and anxiety is really just signaling that they're on the wrong side of history.
Chris Lehman, but also Laurie, I want to hear about this point of view about white guys in suits. I'm as against them as she is, but I see it a little differently. She's talking about as if it is a gender issue. To me, it's a truth issue. The problem with Tom Friedman is not his suit. It's the fact that he swallowed that war hook, line, and sinker. Chris, get us started here.
All right. Well, greetings from the wrong side of history, I want to say. No. I also welcome the, you know, everything about diversity. And one of the great...
And so do I.
You know, contributions that David Carr made was at City Paper and elsewhere. He championed black writers. He really made a point in you know, I just know this from being in D.C., you know, it's a very African-American majority city. It's very segregated. It's very segregated in its media institutions. And since this is sort of in David's honor, I just wanted to briefly call that out. The larger point is, you know, I do think there is a diversity of voices. I don't think it's created spontaneously by media technologies. I don't think Twitter is automatically democratic. And I don't think, you know, what I was starting to say about my experience at Yahoo is, you know, everything there, if you are interested in sort of in a version of Black Twitter on Yahoo, they can provide that to you.
But I want to get Laurie Penny back in on this, on the guys in suits. I mean, Alexis de Tocqueville was a white guy in a suit in a way. He didn't learn from cab drivers. He scoured the country. A lot of great journalists have done it. Why don't we judge these people on their content, on their and on their blunders, not their gender?
Well, it would be nice to live in a world where every single person was judged on the content of their writing and the content of their thought and their inquiry. And until now, we have lived in a world where the only people who were judged only on their thought and only on their reporting were those white guys in suits. Everybody else was judged through a prism of gender or race or class. And what's interesting is that you're seeing a change whereby it's not just diverse voices, it's not just token people who are representing diverse points of view. It's not just, you know, people championing women of color, it's those people of color, those women rising to positions of power, and that is what makes people anxious right now. That's the change that
hold it there. The media maven we're missing when we come back. David Carr, in his own words and in the memory of his Boston University students. This is Open Source. The man we are missing and mourning this hour, David Carr, covered and lived the evolution of the news business for the New York Times. He was a new media guy, but with a huge affection for the old. Here he is speaking recently at a Boston University forum.
I'm speaking to young people in the audience. When your kids are going to grow up, you say, yeah, and I had a friend that worked at the newspaper, and they'll say, well, what was that? You see, well, what they did is they decided at a certain point in the day to stop gathering news, write it all down, smush it onto paper, print it, and then roll it up in bundles and go and whip it into people's yards. They're going to say, no one would ever do that. You say, no, there were things called paper boys and paper girls, and they would, like, whip them into people's yards. Here's your news. I was flying over to Dublin, which is not a place I know well, but they gave out the Irish Times on the way over. I could smell the place and feel the place in that newspaper. I felt like I was a narrative of what was going on. I felt like that it was a rigorous and true mirror of what was going on there, and it made me feel like I was part of something. We're not going to spend a lot of time talking about back in the day. Back in the day, for one thing, it's gone. For another, you know what? It wasn't really all that great. If you think about in real time, we can now know whether what the source is telling is true or not. If they're ducking us, we can stalk them on Facebook. We can get them on LinkedIn. We can pop up on Twitter. We can guess at what their email is. The bag of tricks that the average journalist has is so much bigger.
That was David Carr thinking out loud at a BU campus forum. And here is a sampling of what David Carr taught his journalism class about this changeable feast of business that they were about to enter. Our producer, Max Larkin, distilled some students' memories.
I guess in some ways, David was our journalism parent. And he wasn't just for us. I mean, there are legions of David Carr disciples out there.
I lost my biggest advocate, and I think a lot of other young journalists felt that way too.
He had other little like phrases that he would use, like ABP, always be pimping. It means send those stories out. If you write something that's good, send it to people who matter, people who can spread that around. Even stick it on your friggin' LinkedIn if you need to. Just, you know, make sure that your stories get out there and don't be ashamed.
He's inherently impatient about copy, and he knows when people are shooting the bull with their writing, and he calls them out on it.
When he yelled at us, he was right. And it's sort of hard to fault someone for being right.
He had no tolerance for people who think that diversity is an academic conceit. You know, newsrooms that rely on
clanky old white men aren't going to be the newsrooms that are successful anymore.
He believed that we were in a golden age of journalism, which is something that you really don't hear often right now. He believed in the quality of young journalists. He believed in the internet. He believed in the changing face of journalism. And that was really refreshing and really helpful for us.
As a freelancer who would definitely love temporary permanence and some health insurance, I think I agree with him that this is a time when anyone can go out there and do anything.
I think that was something that David always encouraged us to do, is to tell stories because they need to be told. Tell stories because we needed to, just for us.
Those are the BU students of the late David Carr. David Carr's protege, Ta-Nehisi Coates, is taking over his course, which has got to be interesting. Laurie Penny is with us in the studio. She writes for the New Statesman in London. She just reminded me she has, in effect, Christopher Hitchens' old job. Don't drink the way he did.
No,
think the way he did.
I'm quitting smoking.
But think of those young students. Whom do you want to recruit? How do you judge talent? What should they be looking for? And then where do you point them for jobs on their own or otherwise that could make a living, could pay the rent somewhere?
Well, honestly, the big question is between it's whether I'm hiring in the UK or the US. I'm not hiring at the moment at all because I'm a filthy freelancer and I mainly do my work sitting in my room in my underwear whilst eating snacks with one hand. But if I were in a hiring position, I would suggest that young people in the United States work hard on their freelance stories and look for somewhere which will give them health insurance, which again is a whole other avenue of injustice. The dominance of the corporate market and the corporate media market would not be quite so strong at the moment were it not for things like benefits, which are forcing young people to go the corporate route, even if they might not want to. It is far less feasible to do that in the United States than it is, for example, in Europe, where I'm from. What I look for in young journalists, and a lot of young journalists come to me at the moment, is raw talent wherever it comes from. But what I'm doing at the moment, I get a lot of inquiries. I get a lot of people coming asking for help. I'm just one person. I can't answer every single one of them. And I feel a duty to take particular care answering young women writers, young people of colour, young queer people, people who may not have had all of the leg ups, all of the nepotistic help, and to amplify those voices wherever I can. Those are the young writers. As long as they have the talent, and an extraordinary number of the people who write to me do, they have the talent and the hunger. What I notice, actually, the difference I notice in the emails I get, is a very striking difference. And it's not universal, but a lot of young white men will write to me and say, I think I want to be a journalist. You know, I think I should be a journalist. That sounds like a good thing to be. Whereas all the other people who write to me, the young women, young people of colour, they will say, I want to tell these stories. Here are the things I've written. Here is what I'm interested in. These are not people who are going into journalism because they think that's the sort of thing that people like them should do. They're going into journalism and writing because they feel a great drive to tell truths that have not yet been told.
Yeah, truth has a lot to do with it. I want to ask you and Chris Lehman, what's the test of what Hemingway called the built-in, and we used to be proud of it as Americans, crap detector, which is a test of character, but it's also a test of intellect. Someone with a built-in suspicion that they're being conned, and how they test it, how they push back, how they inquire, how they disregard discouragement. Laurie, and then Chris.
Well, to come back to Aisha's white guys in suits idea, I think obviously the C-word detector is not universal to any one demographic group. But one of the things I'm seeing is that people who have grown up with various kinds of depression of oppression are used to being conned. We have been conned all our lives in various ways. We are used to seeing through media lies and seeing ourselves and our experiences unrepresented. And one of the things that I'm hearing is an anxiety, particularly from the old guard of the press, particularly from people who look a lot like the old guard, that women, queer people, people of colour might actually know different and better and more about what it is to live in a world of oppression and lies. Sorry, I can't say that on the radio. That kind of detector is so much more powerful if you've got used to it from a young age.
Chris Lehman, I want to hear your take, but I also just want to pursue that notion of the different strands and themes, especially the comedy one, that is in so many ways promising, especially after the glorious John Stewart record. Could we listen to a little bit of John Oliver, sort of child of John Stewart, Englishman? But he makes you wonder, in this case, if the way to talk about this inequality issue is to make it, first of all, ridiculous.
You would think in a democracy, policies that benefit very few people at the expense of very many would not be able to succeed, but they have. And I think the reason for that may lie somewhere in America's greatest quality, optimism. It's basically in how susceptible Americans are to this.
We have never been a nation of haves and have-nots. We are a nation of haves and soon-to-haves, of people who have made it and people who will make it.
Yes. No. Hold on. That sounds great. The problem is it makes no sense, economically, mathematically, or even grammatically. And yet we believe him.
Who was it that said the solution was to put Brian Williams at the Comedy Channel and Jon Stewart at NBC Nightly News?
Oh, that might create new orders of difficulty on both sides. But I think what's important to isolate in that John Oliver clip is he's talking about something that used to be a very sort of elemental to the experience of journalists of whatever other kind of identity property in this country. They were not members of a professional managerial class. They came overwhelmingly from a working class background. And I think, you know, if you take a little longer view of the history of American journalism, a lot of its most, you know, the practitioners on the side of truth, the people who would call out crap, as I think we can acceptably call it here, you know, they did not matriculate at an Ivy League institution. They did not get advanced degrees in journalism. They learned journalism as a trade. You know, they apprenticed, mm-hmm. and something, you know, I certainly agree with Penny that, you know, healthcare is a moral issue that everyone should have access to. I do think something was, however, lost when journalism became a profession with salaries and 401ks. And that was exactly a sense of what it is to not be well off in this country and not be, you know, not have an elite education.
Your turn, Laurie Penny.
Well, if you ask many of the young people in journalism right now, I think the experience of living below the poverty line and of not having a secure and privileged job is fortunately or unfortunately definitely coming back in general, despite the fact that it is a very exciting time still to be a journalist. But I think what is illuminated in that John Oliver clip is the quality of exposing corrupt and weird ideologies, exposing not just the small lies in local government, in state government, in the lies told to us every day by politicians, but the big lies, the lies on which we construct our idea of what it is to be American or British or a woman or a man or any kind of person living in this society. What is a democracy? Those are the big questions that people are starting to ask again. I think it is comedians that are leading the charge. It's people who are coming from outside what we used to call mainstream media, and we now, in a telling twist of terminology, call legacy media. It's those big questions are starting to be examined again, and it started first online. It is moving to the mainstream, it's moving to legacy media, but, you know, I remember reporting on the Occupy movement, reporting on the burgeoning feminist movement, and they tell those stories in a new and different way. And it is happening because a period of immense a crisis in capitalism, a crisis in society has collided with a massive change in communications technology. I don't believe we have seen the end game of that twofold change in society by any means. I think it will be beyond my lifetime.
Come back to the profile of David Carr himself. Fascinating, because he was so untimesian, and yet he was embraced by Arthur Sulzberg. He said one of the great men that ever worked for the paper, precisely for leading confidently toward a different horizon. In other words, he was there right between the new media types trying to become institutions and the institutional legacy media, as you call them, trying to, you know, learn some new tricks. And it's quite unclear to me yet who we should be rooting for. And I'm still reading the New York Times, but maybe believing it less and less. What's going on?
Well, there is a massive anxiety over who is going to get to tell the story of the next 20 years. And when you talk in that montage we heard at the start, journalism is stories, stories, stories. What's the story? What's this and that? And the idea of a story, the idea of human beings as a storytelling creature, is something that's really interesting right now. It's the internet, new communications technologies are not only changing the story, they are changing who gets to tell it, who gets to sit and listen, who has to pay for it, and that is changing and will change everything that it means to produce and consume journalism right now. Because what is journalism? Journalism is just another story. Journalism is a story that we tell ourselves about what it means to speak truth to power and about what it means to speak truth
to
people.
For today, under deadline pressure, that's about it. And it'll be different tomorrow, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But the idea of journalism as a vaunted ideal, as something that you either go into and you are a journalist. Journalist is an identity. I speak to the journalists that I know, so from different generations, different backgrounds, and you know, they say, I am a journalist with pride. And I want to know what that means today, because I think what it means to be a journalist is changing. A lot of the people I see out there doing the best investigations, the best reports, the best blog posts and articles would not even think of themselves as journalists. And the democratization of journalism itself is a pattern that I'm very interested to see play out. I think it's an incredible time to be doing this kind of work.
Chris Lehman, last word.
Well, I agree with probably, you know, half of what Penny is saying.
My name's Laurie.
Laurie Penny.
Yes, I'm sorry. But I feel like, you know, that we go overboard in hailing technologies as inherently democratic. I think the kind of accountability journalism we're talking about, holding powerful institutions and people accountable for their actions and holding the profession of journalism itself accountable for its failures, that's a question of, you know, committing ourselves to, you know, do this work as you're saying, day by day, to tell the truth and run, as Gilbert Seldes used to say. But also, you know, to not buy into the idea that a technology is inherently liberating. The same technologies we're discussing as unleashing all of this immense democratic power are the technologies by which we are being surveilled by our government. And, you know, that itself is an interesting story that has, you know, gotten a lot of traction from non-traditional media sources.
Absolutely.
But it's also a story that we have to tell in a way that speaks to everyone and not just sub-communities talking to each other on Twitter or on Facebook or on social media. There, part of the mission of journalism is actually to enact what it is to live in a democratic society, to open up arguments as broadly as possible.
Chris Lehman, we believe in all of it. We're going to keep doing it. And the internet, for what it's worth, has broken the old AJ labeling rule that freedom of the press belongs to every man who owns one. It is a new world still to be made. Thank you, Chris Lehman and Laurie Penny. And our guests on tape, Derek Ashong, Aisha Siddiqui, and Dylan Matthews, almost. Thanks also to Farnaz Fasihi and David Carr's students, Michaela Lefrak, Brooke Jackson-Glidden, and Jamie Bologna. You can hear a lot more talk about media and the moment after David Carr on our website, radioopensource.org. Our show is produced by Max Larkin and Connor Gillies. Our engineer is George Hicks. Mary McGrath is our managing editor. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.